All right, ladies and gentlemen, M.C. Melodyets is a former business school professor, corporate trainer, advocate of due process and charter rights, and a longtime geopolitical trends propaganda anatomizer. He's Anglo Mohawk, born in urban Western Canada. He has lived, worked, and done research in the UK, France, Germany, Ukraine, Crimea. We call it Crimea, Republic of South Africa, and the Philippines. He did his master's thesis on Putin and the oligarchs, a witness to the Orange Revolution events, a Soros color revolution in Ukraine, the Putsch government installation in Kiev, and jihadi activity while living as a quasi-hermit in the Sinai Desert in the wake of the collapse of the Mubarak regime. He's the former host and producer of Reading Between the Minds, a geopolitics talk radio show broadcasting out of the second largest technical college in Canada. Extensive time spent in relationships with diplomats and personal research overseas further opened M.C. Melodyets' eyes to deep state manipulations taking place in, guess where? North America. Yep, he has taught students from across the breadth of the former Soviet Union. Not a few of his students were employees of the SBU. SBU, that's a new one. I'll get him to clarify this. But KGB is in parentheses here, so we'll keep rolling. His own family members were tortured and deported to the Siberian Gulag during the Soviet era. He has worked with genuine refugees in both Europe and the Middle East. Presently producing a radio show, Red and Purple Sky, a First Nations / Native American Indian youth talk show about life on Great Turtle Island in North America. Moreover, he's also engaged in producing East-West Fire, an English and Russian language current affairs talk radio show with a Soviet-born radio co-host based in Kiev, Ukraine. His book, White Stone and a New Name, is M.C. Melodyets' autobiography of a redeemed prodigal traveler on Earth. His book will be available through Amazon in the very near future. And more details can be found at RBTM Talk. Wow. This is going to be good. MC, welcome to the program. Great to have you here.
Hello, John. It's a privilege. Thank you for having me aboard.
It's very kind of you to say that. Wow. Wow, what a story. So why don't we begin at the beginning? Just take us from the point of your awareness, which has gotten ever more broad as you walk this life path. This is an extraordinary CV. It really is.
Well, John, basically, the beginnings with my eyes being open to what I call the upper floor, what many of us call the deep state, your CIA elements, your State Department machinations, your UN and your European Union operations, obviously not with elected officials and such, began not by looking at what I could see with my eyes, hear with my ears, looking at buildings and day-to-day life here in North America. Basically, all of this began to change for me after I went to live overseas. I ended up coming to live in Kiev, Ukraine, Kiev, the capital of Ukraine, of course, in the former Soviet Union, and meeting a number of people, including a former NATO commander for Ukraine that was sent in. This would be back in the year 2000, as well as other military personnel. I was going to diplomatic parties and get-togethers and started to notice you get different embassy staff. They kind of think everybody knows things already. You have people from the IMF coming in, basically everybody coming to these parties, other ambassadors, and they think everybody knows what's going on already, so they don't have tight lips on these things after one gets speaking, and people get talking about these happenings, and I began to realize that there was a plan to bring Ukraine, which was now a new independent country into something that was being built in the Western world. And of course, there was a major propaganda war that was put into action in order to carry Ukraine forward in these steps through, of course, the Orange Revolution, 2003, 2004, and then up to your Euromaidan, 2012, 2013, the changes this way. Basically, you're looking at a stage-by-stage plan to bring Ukraine into the Western orbit. And of course, that has a lot to do with the gas lines that run through Ukraine and in the Black Sea to the south of Ukraine, John.
It's always about the money somehow, isn't it?
Well, you've got a lot of, you've basically got two levels that your listeners want to look at when they understand. The question gets asked, do you have a Ukrainian grassroots movement that happened with these East-West changes? Is it something on a bigger level? Well, the fact is, we should look at things always in a multidimensional way. You're looking, you have a micro level and you have a macro level. The micro level of what happened in Kiev and in Ukraine in these years past, building up to the present time, is you had general aspirations by regular Ukrainian people to have a free country for themselves, which they had wanted from time past. And at the same time, you had deep state realities in the West that decided we're going to make moves in order to bring Ukraine, the Soviet Union no longer existing, bringing Ukraine into our orbit. Now, John, when I was in Ukraine in the year 2000, I can remember European Union Land Rovers downtown in the middle of the city. They were carrying out meetings with the then Kuchma government in Ukraine in order to make steps to bring Ukraine in this direction. There are also moves by the International Monetary Fund, the IMF, to end all of the money changers on the street. There's tons of them there. You could change money, not just in the banks, like in some countries, the United States, Canada, and such, Great Britain, but you could go to little kiosks. That's where we get the word kiosk. It's a Russian word. And change your money, buy US dollars, whatever you need to do, euros. And the IMF representatives came in under the direction of their up hands in order to close down those money changing operations so that you could have a movement to control higher up where the flow of money for these kinds of things could be, well, better monitored. And further with, yes.
No, further. That's okay.
Further with that, so basically you're looking at this. When we speak about our deep state, when we speak about the upper floor, which includes your running of the entire Western world in this sense, and again, we're not getting into what some people would call conspiracy theory or some sort of ethereal kind of thing. We're talking about realities that are hard text, researched realities, things that people can observe. You've got embassies, you have diplomats who have been openly talking about these kinds of things for years. This isn't just something from 2 hours back. Now, at a lot of the embassy get-togethers that I had been attending, people were talking about the changes going on. And of course, in the early years, this was simply presented as Ukraine is being westernized, it's coming into liberties that it's never known before. Basically, at the time, I saw this as a good thing. I saw the idea of Ukraine being brought in to the Western orbit as something positive. Now, what I began to realize as I spent more time in the Ukrainian capital was that you had games being played where people were being prepared on location for changes that were coming, namely with the Orange Revolution and namely with the Euromaidan. Now, your listeners might ask, I mean, of course, knowing what they know already, you knowing what you know, what is the difference between what happened with the Orange Revolution back in 2003 and 4, and the Euromaidan in 2012, 2013, and of course, even further along there. The dates are a little different because you had your build-up times, not just the time that the Western camera crews were on location in the city. So that's very important for us to understand. Basically, the big difference is the Orange Revolution was where Ukrainian people's minds, on average, your average Ukrainian person, the mentality began to change, where they began to think in a more open way and moving beyond initial fears that they grew up with about speaking out, challenging government. Whereas with the Euromaidan movement and changes there, by then, your deep state upper floor levels were already thoroughly involved in operations in Ukraine in order to bring the country into the Western orbit. All of this stuff, State Department talk, Hillary Clinton, Samantha Power, all that kind of language and buildup that was done before the fighting actually began on the streets of Kiev. It's interesting, during the initial Orange Revolution, signals were cut in Ukraine, and we had to go to an Irish pub, actually, where there was a satellite link in order to find out what was going on throughout the rest of Kiev and other parts of the country. Now, keep in mind, during the Orange Revolution of 2003 and 4, we didn't have the social media tools that we would later have, like you had at Tahrir Square in Egypt and such later on with your Arab Spring, quote-unquote. Now, with Euromaidan, the difference, the social media tools were in place. There was a lot more room for people to speak. But by that time, the upper levels, State Department, had already come in. Promises, excuse me, with the IMF for funding for Ukraine. Basically, we need to understand this, is Ukraine was broke for most of this time. They needed to be floated by loans in order to keep the government operating day to day. Of course, you remember not too long ago, there was a U.S. government shutdown, and I mean, of course, games involved there, but the Ukrainian government had no money to operate. So who was there to provide that? The IMF, of course, in place. But the clincher to take that money was you have to shut down your what are called abminvalyut, your money change kiosks in Ukraine. Now, of course, this involves taxation, and we won't get into that right now, but you can understand already you're looking at a centralization of control. When Ukraine came out of a collapsed Soviet Union, Moscow was no longer there to look after the people, but Kiev was not up to a place where it was able to look after the people of Ukraine. So you had all these different changes going on between the Orange Revolution and the Euromaidan events that you saw on television. And again, what you saw on television was, we're going to bring Ukraine into the Western orbit. We want to get them away from the bad, hard Russians. And of course, to any story, there are many sides. And of course, that was the reality in these circumstances.
Let me see if we can get our terminology dialed in here. I'm not sure how important this is to everybody in the audience, but it's important to me. Why do they name it things like the Orange Revolution? Well, what does that mean?
The orange was a color that was picked up by the early organizers and people on the street. It was a color being used by a party at that time that tended to be more liberal in nature at the time, small L. So people picked it up. They were wearing clothing of the orange color. That's how it began, John.
And what does Maidan mean?
Maidan means independence in Ukrainian.
Okay. Well, that doesn't get out over MSM here. Formerly known as mainstream media, now known as Ministry of Smoke and Mirrors, as you may already know. All right, and would you mind telling everybody the correct pronunciation of C-R-I-M-E-A?
Crimea.
It is Crimea.
Yeah, in Russian we say Krim, Krim.
Krim.
But in English, Crimea.
Okay, good. I'm hearing Crimea. I'm hearing everything. So
Crimea.
Okay.
Crimea.
Thanks. That's what it was called traditionally, and then we abandoned it, you know. The Americans go back and forth between, is it Nagano, Japan, or Nagano? I like Nagano, don't you? It's like, no, that's not right. Okay, so then, well, now let's back up just a little bit. You are very, very much full immersion into these studies. You have students, you have talk shows, you're very active in getting out the word. At what point did you go from student to teacher, so to speak?
Well, basically, John, and again, for your listeners here, once I arrived in Kiev, I wasn't just coming into a capital city that you'd look at on a colored map. I basically arrived and ended up living in Gotham City.
Wow.
I was living in Gotham City. It was like being stuck in a black and white movie for many years. I was there for over 10 years. Of course, I was back and forth out of the country during that period. But I basically found myself in a city where the government was not your friend. The mafia ruled the country. The police didn't have enough money for gasoline to run their cars, so they weren't out on the highways patrolling, looking after people, keeping things secure. You couldn't go to the police because there are corruption issues there as well. And then you had your different levels of mafia, not just one. It isn't a singular term. You have different levels. And we have a term in Russian, krisha. It means roof. Everybody has a roof. There's always a higher level of mafia, some figure that you have to bow to, that you have to abide by. So my transition from student to teacher basically came in living in a society where I found I couldn't use my adult skills anymore. I showed up. I might have known 10 words in Russian and Ukrainian in total. I had never been to the place before, but just living there, I began to explore. Now, you'll find this quite interesting. The society at that time was not being guarded or looked after in a proper way. Basically, you had security guards on duty, but they weren't being paid enough, John, to care. So what I did is I went around and I would enter into buildings. I mean, just kind of like in a exploratory way. I mean, nothing closed. And I was going into, for example, chemistry and physics institutes that would have been totally forbidden for us to go into during the Soviet period. And I was just walking around, going up staircases, often staircases because the elevators were broken or you never quite knew if they were going to work. I had to climb up my first apartment building. Now is about 12 stories high in the city. It's basically a city of very tall concrete apartment buildings, if you want to get the scene, that just cover the horizon. And I'd go up the staircase because the elevator wouldn't work regularly. And because people were just living hand to mouth, people would steal the light bulbs. You couldn't see your way around inside of the building, inside the staircase. So you'd basically be crawling up. I'd go up the stairs, feeling my way up. And you would literally, because you can't see the wall or the floor number, you just have to count. You'd have to figure out by feel which floor of the building you're on in the darkness. Gotham City is what Kiev was when I arrived. That was my transition from student to teacher and of course, ongoing process.
How did you wind up in that part of the world?
Well, I initially went over there was a big call at the time in that part of the world, Ukraine, Russia, Romania. There were a lot of young people in orphanages who were basically just being dumped by the government. You had orphanages, John, that were being given maybe $40, $50 for 400 children inside of them to run as a budget for an entire month. and these kids were supposed to eat on this. So we went in there. I had a friend who was involved with an outreach out of Norway, and we were involved with some local people, child psychologist, former policeman, assistant director to an orphanage. So we were helping these kids in this situation. I mean, they were going hungry. You could see just malnourished faces. There was no money. Now, it's interesting. We were bringing some supplies in at the time through the border, the Polish-Ukrainian land border, and we were stopped by the guards there. And, you know, they said, what are you up to? And we said, well, we're bringing food to orphanages inside of your country. And they said, not understanding the volunteerism that you and I are used to here in the West, saying nobody does that without money. This, you have to be making money out of this somehow. This is some kind of business. So this is the kind of mentality we are dealing with, trying to help in these ways. You had basically, there was no light in many of the buildings. There was no heat. So you're in places where it was always cold. You're always wearing warm coats, parkas this way, just to keep warm. But this is what people had to live with. It was by candlelight. You had blackouts in Kiev being the capital, even as the capital city, because there was not power to do your stuff. You try and plug in an early laptop at the time and forget about it. There was no dial-up speed, or you would shut off the fuses would be blown in your apartment when you tried to plug in two different appliances. So there was a lot of infrastructure issues in order just to live day-to-day life. That was another big transition for me from being a student and going into teaching this way. Later on, I would end up doing work as a corporate trainer. I worked for a number of companies, insurance, energy, worked for the government of Kiev, worked for a pharmaceutical company, basically saw where a lot of your professional class were at in their mentalities. What do you think about what's going on? And they would tell me, these aren't people who are just kind of living, doing working class jobs. They had an interest in the future of their country. They just didn't have any resources really of that time. You had it, what are called your new Ukrainians or your new Russians. These are people that ended up with millions of dollars overnight. Just they were, how did they come to this? Well, they were well placed, and they ended up selling off a lot of materiel and making money from Western business people who showed up with suitcases full of cash.
And now, approximately what year would this have been?
This would have been in the year 2000 is gotcha. When I first arrived.
Okay.
Yeah. So,
I'm sorry. I'd rather hear you, but I'm just trying to get a sense of the timeline here. So, and what was happening along it. So they're under the Soviet boot, so to speak, for a while. So it's lots of concrete and gray, and you do what you're told, and there's KGB all over the place. And so you're minding right. Your P's and Q's, and then the Soviet Union collapsed, and it's like somebody pulled the plug on their civilization, and now it's a free-for-all run by gangsters. Is that basically it?
That's right. The Soviet Union collapsed, of course, in 1991. You know, our older listeners would remember better. And basically, John, after that, you had a 10-year period where you had a depression in the former Soviet Union that was twice as bad as the depression that we had in the United States in the 1930s. So people, all the factories ground to a halt, and they would still show up to factories hoping to get paid. You had barter introduced, the currency, for example, in Ukraine, the ruble collapsed, and they introduced something called the coupon, and it was worth only that. And afterwards, they introduced the hryvnia. And so you had all kinds of weird stuff going on. People ended up as coupon currency millionaires, and they bought immovable property at the time from that currency and stuff that they never could have bought out of just regular Soviet wages. So We had changes, 10-year period, where people didn't know whether they were coming or going. The government was not there anymore. A lot of people who were in power in the Soviet Union before emigrated to the United States and other Western countries during that period. They also fled with a lot of money. There were a number of trials at that time to try and get that money back. And people were basically just, by and large, John, trying to survive day-to-day life, going out to the food markets and trying to find carrots and lettuce and potatoes to eat. There was no food in the supermarkets, and people were just trying to make it. How did they make it? A lot of people in the cities survived on vegetables from relatives living out in the countryside. People couldn't afford to buy meat. They were living on soup meals, soup and bread, for the better part of a decade.
I'm sorry to just keep seeming to just hammer at the same thing, but I guess in the broad strokes, my question is, how does such a thing happen? How, if you back engineer this, how did this happen? Was it just like not good to begin with, and then when the major controls out of Moscow cut the cable, they were just in free fall? I mean, is that it? I mean, infrastructure crumbling, factories closing, internet, and forget about it. No light in the stairwell, all of this. This is a nightmare scenario. This really sounds like something out of a hell dream.
It was truly Gotham City, John, with the way people were trying to live, except without a Batman. I mean, it was, you had people who were afraid at the time to go out of their apartment buildings because you never knew it was going to happen. You had mafia operating on the streets. There was just gangsterism everywhere. You know, you've heard about all of your New Odessa stuff, your Brighton Beach in New York and this crowd. Those people, before they came over to the States, they had free rein across the former Soviet Union. And that's what was going on for us in Kiev and through Ukraine at the time. Basically, when people ask me, what's the difference, MC, between Russia and Ukraine? Basically, you're dealing with the same kind of people. Russians tend to be more of a dominant personality. Ukrainians tend to be more passive in who they are. But by and large, culturally, they're the same kind of people. And what happened, I need to mention as a precursor, with the breakup of the Soviet Union. Basically, you had Western bankers visit Mikhail Gorbachev, who was Secretary General of the Communist Party at the time, the leader of the Presidium, and the Premier of the Soviet Union all at once. And they basically said, look, Soviet Union, you know it, we know it, is a false economy. It's not going to last very much longer. We're willing to help you transition into a market economy. Now, they had something called the Shatalin 500-day plan, which was going to be this transition period. Now, of course, for your average former Soviet person, they thought that they were going to go through, yeah, some difficulties, but basically not much different than what Poland went through or Hungary or East Germany, that they it would be a doable kind of transition, except that's not what happened. One, because the mentality of people in the Soviet Union was not westernized enough. It wasn't market enough. Basically, people at the time, John, in the former Soviet Union, even after the breakup of the Soviet Union, didn't understand what we would call economics 101. They didn't understand basic business principles. A lot of Westerners went in afterwards and they were working like myself in corporate positions and colleges and such. And we were teaching people about a lot of these basics that maybe we in the United States and other countries take for granted, just as something you grew up in a home with because you understand private enterprise principles. But the people at that time, through that 10-year period, depression again worse than the depression that the United States had in the 30s, didn't know what to do with themselves. They were stuck. People had no money. They didn't have any food. So there started to be a climb upward, getting close to the Orange Revolution. The economy rose up. You started to get a lot of Western companies and others come in from other countries, from Asia as well. And they began to build new offices, new buildings. So people started to get hired, and you started to get access by more people to better wages, better salaries. And this is what you had going on beginning at the time of the Orange Revolution, 2003-2004. You had about a five-year bubble after that Orange Revolution, in which the only thing, John, people were talking about was the price of real estate and what the price of real estate was going to be tomorrow. That's all people were talking about. That you had one-bedroom apartments in Kiev selling for a couple $100,000 US. I mean, it was crazy. So people were operating in levels of money that they had never been used to, formally knowing about Soviet level kinds of wages, that kind of familiarity.
This is extraordinary. Now, where does George Soros fit into the Orange Revolution?
Well, George Soros is interesting. He's actually a bit of a household name with myself, not because of high level banking, of course, but because he founded and funded a university in Budapest, Hungary, called the Central European University. I used to go to Hungary quite often. I would be needing to go there for business or renewing a visa or something. You know, it's a shorter distance. It's just over the border from Ukraine. So everybody there in Budapest knows about George Soros from way back, before he was in the media, before he was in the Ministry of Smoke and Mirrors, and only the part of the story they tell you about him this way. But George Soros has been involved with color revolution involvements and manipulations from way back. The revolution in Georgia was another example. Ukraine, of course, changes in many different countries this way. I'll focus just more on areas that I know more, but we've known about him, John, for a long time. George Soros is definitely not somebody who just came along yesterday for us.
And how is he regarded generally?
Well, basically, people in the when I first started to live in the former Soviet Union, people there began to realize that their old history about the Russian Revolution, which actually we're coming into the anniversary of 1917, we're coming into this month, people began to realize what they were taught in their history classes in school was not the case. Now, many schools that I taught in, there was one whole quarter of the curriculum was just ripped out of the textbooks, out of the schools. At the time I was there, they removed all the old communism stuff. But people began to realize, John, at that time, for the first time, that what they had been told was not the case. Now, your listeners know that already, that people went through that kind of a change and eyes opening and realization. But more into the specifics, people living in the former Soviet Union, people in Kiev began to realize that you didn't have just simply Lenin, Trotsky, Stalin do a bunch of things locally in St. Petersburg and voila, you have a revolution going on. You had a Western banking coup as a reality with your Bolshevik revolution, with your Russian revolution. Now, I have to say, when I first arrived, I also came with our regular Western history, you know, thinking about what had happened, that it was a local reality that touched off the Russian Revolution. That was it. Why not think that? Why not? That's what we were told. They were taught what they were taught in their history classes, in their society, in the Soviet Union. In the same way, we were taught what we were taught in the Western world. It worked well. You've got a bipolar world, Cold War. Hey, makes it simpler for people who are maybe not interested in doing deeper research and looking at those kinds of changes. So these revelations began to become a big eye-opener for me. Okay, we're not dealing with the history that we are taught about in schools. Yes, I had read about this in textbooks and my own research before when I was still living in Canada. I had read that. But hearing people talk about this, doing research the further in the former Soviet Union, what else was I doing there? Basically, John, during the period that I was in the former Soviet Union, I probably ended up interviewing near 1,000 people who were basically veterans and survivors of World War II, of the Holocaust in the Soviet Union and the Ukrainian terror famine, and basically taking the eyewitness accounts, correlating them with research written details that were already available for anyone to read, and seeing, John, what the common denominators for and what the common denominators were. Now, why am I speaking about this? I'm speaking about it in the sense that sometimes people are watching television, they're looking at their social media, and they've got one source, and they've got one big television channel. The Soviets, of course, had Pravda and Izvestia. Your listeners know Pravda. And really what we have that has grown up here in the West, it's always been, but it's more pronounced now, is we are becoming the new Pravda here in the West, in the United States, but we don't want to admit it to ourselves because we've got kind of a growing up in grace that many of us have had. The thinking is it can't happen here. This is what the mind says. It's like a cognitive dissonance. It happens, overseas in those countries that have always been known to be dictatorships and these kinds of trains of thought. And we need to come out of this way of thinking because our own societies are going through transitions that are quickly bringing us away from the democratic ways, a republic based upon constitutional principles, values that you can't just throw aside at a moment. And again, bringing to light what has gone on here, the story with the officer Rapone at West Point opening up his uniform and the Che Guevara shirt. I mean, this isn't a game playing around with, this picture that communism is some kind of dreamy thing and there's no issue of concern there. Members of my own family, mentioned earlier, were taken by the then KGB, the NKVD, arrested in Ukraine and deported to Siberia. I had a family member of mine, a great-grandfather, who ended up being sentenced to a 10-year term in the gulag. They sent him back home. Now, this is how these people are. This is the kind of psychology of terror they use with people. I don't think any of our listeners would ever want to see this in the United States or where we're living, that they released my great-grandfather back to his wife and family for a 10-year period. And then after he kind of got used to things, they scooped him back up, sent him back out to Siberia by rail for another prison term out there. This is how these people operate. It's not just the physical military stuff. Now, John, in the Soviet Union, there was something used to basically intimidate dissidents. Okay, dissidents, people that don't want to conform with the regime, dissidents. They used something called sikushka. It's basically, they take a person into very often not just a jail or a prison, but a psychiatric hospital, and basically say things to them like, "Well, do you believe in God?" and they'd put a pillow down on their face. If you can picture this, you're in a room holding up a pillow. It's coming down on your face. What do you do? And you're tied down in this bed. This is what the KGB would do with people to try to break them. Nobody wants to see this sort of thing, but this is the mentality. This is the kind of thing that gets unleashed when people start walking in these mindsets like you have with communism. Whether we're saying communism, socialism, whatever, let's not get lost in the language. It's a behavior. You're dealing with deterministic people who operate in a Machiavellian way. They're willing to do cruel things because they believe the end justifies the means.
I cannot resist going here for just a moment, MC, and that is, do they do it because they think it's the proper methodology, or do they do it because they're just plain bleeping evil, godless, and mean?
You have two kinds of people. You've got those who are simply state employees. They're in there. But obviously, if you're going to be a part of the KGB, you're not serving as a normal Soviet Army soldier or officer. There's a big difference. Soviet Army people were conscripted. You had to go to service. I actually had younger members of the same family of mine that I mentioned who were in the Red Army as well. They were forced into it. You had to go into it. But KGB types were picked and brought into a duty. And you had people in there, they're functionaries, you get that type. And then the second type are sadists. They're sadists. They basically deal with people. And it's like, if you're going to operate against the regime, you're clearly a good for nothing. So we're going to deal with you because you're trying to bring down the only society that we know. You're in the way, and we don't want trouble from types like you.
So that sadism thing, that's absolutely positively real. I mean, we see examples of this every once in a while when we'll see some CIA, some torture picture will get out, and the looks on their faces of the torturers are absolutely insane. They look psychopathic, just wide-eyed, and they've got that, you know.
There's a steely look, a coldness in the eyes that one notices right away, especially in those earlier years. When I first arrived, people were very cold, emotionless. And of course, the flip side of it is the local people usually would know if you're from the West because they can see an easygoingness inside of you that comes from us growing up here in North America or other parts of the Western world where we grew up in grace, we grew up in light. And because of that, and I'll have to say, there's no mistake in asking about this, that is from Judeo-Christian foundations that we have here on this continent, here on Turtle Island, indigenous people describe this continent. But there is a grace there, regardless of mistakes and problems. Our worst days here, no comparison whatsoever with what people were living with in the Soviet Union. Now, the latter years of the Soviet Union were not that bad. You had price controls. If you obeyed and didn't challenge the government, it was usually not bad as long as you weren't in the gulag. The years early so in the Soviet Union were horrible. They were, Stalin killed 20 million of his own people, and the German army, of course, with the Third Reich, Hitler, the invasion of the Soviet Union, Operation Barbarossa, 20 million people were killed that way. So you're basically looking at a society, John, where 40 million people were killed. So you have a trauma that came out of that as a shockwave where people were not allowed, didn't feel like they could speak. Like if you came to political meetings on the street, like we're dealing with, we've got Berkeley, we've got speakers coming out. If you came out to meetings in Soviet society, very often the normal situation is plainclothes KGB officers would come up and go, okay, we don't need to be here. Everybody move off and nothing to see here kind of thing, you know, to use Sadiq Khan, mayor of London's language.
Right.
So people were basically, you had people who came out of the Russian Empire with a slave mentality to begin with, coming into a Soviet Union that proclaimed that there was freedom of religion. But of course, your listeners know what you have on paper is totally different in reality. The Stalin Constitution of 1937 and the Brezhnev Constitution of 1977 both said that Soviet people had freedom of religion. But do you think it was the case?
No. So, I don't think they had freedom of anything.
They didn't have freedom of anything except they would let people kind of have fun and you can do what you wanted to do later on in your apartments. But have no mistake about it, people did not light religious candles in their windowsills in the early years of the Soviet Union, and really not even in the latter years, because you would get a knock on the door. It's called stuchat. It means a knock, and you would disappear at 4 a.m. Now it's interesting. After I arrived in Kiev, John, in the year 2000, and in the time following that, I ended up not by my own plan. I mean, you never know who you're going to meet, and people are closed. They're not like Westerners. They don't open up easier. They don't open up the way we do, and it's still the case to this day. I ended up meeting in cafes people who are working as employees of the KGB, the SBU in Ukraine, the FSB, they're known as in the Russian Federation. And we would get talking. I'd kind of joke with them to lighten them up, and they'd be having a couple beers. I'd usually get a coffee. They'd kind of think I was strange, you know, especially when it's like late in the evening, you're ordering a coffee, but that's what I would do. And we'd get talking and they would lighten up by that point. They'd be coming from work. And I would joke with them and I would say, well, you don't knock on people's doors, you know, in early morning hours and take them away anymore, do you? And of course, they would laugh about that and say, no, 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 we don't do that anymore. You see, what's important to understand is, and I mention this because of all this Russian propaganda that we've had with our mainstream media, the corporate media, about the Russians, Putin, basically talking about them like they're communists and that that's the current state of people over there to this day. Well, in short, that is not the case. Communism over in the former Soviet Union is a spent idea. They lost all of those people, 40 million dead, John. Nobody wants that stuff anymore. Everybody over there lost family members. Their people went into the gulag. They faced intimidation, sakushka, by the KGB. So the young generations that came up who still ended up going for jobs, and a lot of people did it because it was not because they were killers or murderers, but because the jobs were prestigious. A very good friend of mine got a job offer as an early computer programmer in Kiev at the end of the Soviet Union. And he did this work because his girlfriend thought it would be a good job for him, you know, wanted to be with somebody, salary's nicer, you can talk about it with the girlfriends, but not sure, because he's a killer, yeah. So this is not where people are at with Soviet people, with Russian, Ukrainian people today. You have your gangster mentality. You have that. You have that kind of cold type, the people who are willing to resort to violence. That is there. Yes, it is. But communism, that idea that the mainstream media tries to paint on Putin and others there, yes, Putin was an officer in the KGB who is based in Dresden. I also lived in Dresden myself. He's a household name there. Everybody kind of, even the Germans there, treat him as one of their own because of his time being posted there. But they're not into it. They know that it doesn't check out. It's like a false economy, communism. it doesn't work. So a lot of people, they still got positions as employees, but they're not into your hard regime stuff as in the past. They're able to compare their present time with times past and decided, no, we don't want that earlier stuff. We're trying to come out of our night into the light, and this is the way we're choosing to go. This is the attitude of most people in this part of the world.
MC, so these leftists over here, these collectivists, these Marxists, these bloody communists, I'm inclined to make a cursory term for them. How about misguided idiots who have no idea how dangerous what they're fooling with actually is? Am I close?
Well, it's interesting. You'll remember, and of course, many of your listeners will remember back in the late 80s, the early 90s, it was kind of said that the only communists still left around were a few professors in a number of your Ivy League universities. We thought, okay, whatever, but there's just a few of them. But we made a mistake in that to think you only had a handful of people who were buying into this communist philosophy, this ideology this way. At the same time as you had these people teaching in these universities, what they were doing behind the scenes were sowing into a new generation of Americans about an overthrowing of the order. And of course, they tell points that people can agree with. They talk about a robber baron kind of capitalism and look at what your elite, your rich are doing. You don't want a part of that. Socialism is the better way to go about it. Why don't we come aboard in this direction and advocate for change on our campuses, make a new direction this way, equalize things? Now, I just wanted to add to that by saying we've got this talk from Mark Zuckerberg and Elon Musk and others about making a universal wage. Now, when I first began to hear that, experiencing what I did, looking at what we have with the Soviet experience and all of the cost, all of the damage and the pain trying to come out of that pit afterwards, this talk about a universal wage is just basically trying to hoodwink people into getting them onto electronic food stamps. So they give you $1,000 a month. They know exactly how many resources you have each month to use, whether you can resist, whether people have the ability to carry out some kind of uprising. Basically, if people take aboard a universal wage this way, you're looking at serfs. You're looking at peasants.
Absolutely.
More than just the psychology that has been there for many years. If you were to take that aboard and have that made the new normal, you would simply have people who are on, you know, they'd give you like a debit card kind of thing like you've had with Obama, and they would have total control of what you do, like the government had over the people in the Soviet Union, only this time in an electronic way. I'm actually going to be publishing another book beyond my autobiography mentioned. It's called Propiska, Pulse and Perception, where I go into this. That's for another time. But you have this reality whereas the Soviet communists were using physical realities, listening devices and walls. Look, John, we used to have something called kitchen talk that was a result of a divided personality that formed in the Soviet Union. You might say we had a schizophrenia. Now, people had one personality that they'd show with strangers on the street and another personality when they were meeting with friends in their apartments. But even when they were in their own apartments, they would meet in the kitchen, this kitchen talk as we speak, because you could turn on the tea kettle and it's those older noisy types and you got the background noises. You would have to do this because you'd have listening devices in the walls, and of course the local KGB regional person would hear what you're saying. They tape recorded and what have you. This is why, now, when I made my first trip back from the former Soviet Union to North America, and I was traveling back and forth, I had time in Britain and such, I was thinking to myself, with all of your Department of Homeland Security, the Patriot Act, all of this being introduced, I thought, this is insane. Now, it's not that it's some kind of thing on a danger from the left, as with communism, or danger with the right, as with Nazi Germany and the Gestapo. Whether you build, if you're building something to spy on your own people, whether you're talking about KGB or talking about Gestapo, you're looking at two different wings to the same bird. You don't want it. You don't want that in your society. There's no sense of a republic if you are being listened to all the time, because what it does, and this is for those who aren't even considering themselves political types, just your artist types. If you feel somebody is listening to you all the time, this kills creativity. You're not going to want to go and paint your Picasso. You're not going to express. People will curtail their efforts in different areas, trades, and professions in life. So just on this level alone, you introduce this sort of thing, people are going to self-censor themselves. And the larger run on this is you're going to end up hurting the economy of your country. What do I mean by that? You're going to end up having a brain drain out of your country. This is exactly what happened in South Africa, of course, from 93 and earlier.
Well, not to become the young, rough fellow that I still consider myself to be, but that bastard Soros was behind the South African collapse as well. Images of him standing next to F.W. de Klerk are readily to be seen on the internet. Wherever Soros is, chaos and, shall we say, regime change is soon to follow. And it's well known now, largely as a result of, praise the Lord, this program, that people are now beginning to understand that it's the intelligence services, not the officers, the leaders, the collectivist, Marxist, here's your check, leaders inside the intelligence services in South Africa that facilitated the collapse of that government and that society, just as the intelligence services in this country are doing it, just as they did it in the old Soviet Union and in Ukraine. Well, I mean, there's no magic to this, of course. They've got their fingers on every button and around every string. I mean, this is not a tough code to crack, is it?
Well, John, I have family members of my own in South Africa, and I asked them, of course, just from the beginnings, what are you dealing with? I mean, were you? And they said, look, we didn't have apartheid come to an end just in 1993. This was happening way back before this time. Most of the English South African white people didn't even agree with apartheid. You had some reality of holding on to this where it was more popular, but it was more just a mindset amongst your Afrikaner population this way. But here's what's important for us to understand for our purposes here, is that South Africa was self-sufficient in its earlier years. The rand used to be worth more than the British pound. You could travel all around the world on the South African rand. Now, what your globalists on the outside, what your Soros types on the outside didn't like or appreciate, and of course wanting to expand their own business empires and kingdoms, they realized, they understood they needed to penetrate into South Africa, into the South African Republic, if they are going to involve themselves in any deep ways in the southern end of the African continent. Now, South Africa as a republic was the richest country on the African continent. We all know this, your listeners. They had platinum, gold, diamonds, you name it. They're growing wheat. They didn't need the outside world in order to survive. The globalists like Soros understood that. They made a deal with the Klerk's government. They went in, made it look like there was going to be a transition. But in the media, it was all painted to be a race thing. We've got white people, we've got black people, we're going to do a transition, it's going to make it better. We're going to go from white minority rule into black majority rule, which, I mean, really, you're not dealing with a fair spread of black voters and representation. You're looking at a Marxist representation through the ANC. You have Jacob Zuma realities, the changes that happened afterwards. Basically what happened is they put a majority black African ANC government into office so you could see them on camera in Pretoria. South Africa at one point had three different capitals, but just Pretoria for our sake here. And you could see them on television. So voila, you have a change from white minority to black majority control, except that is not what was going on. You basically had your Soros types go in there and buy up shares through a privatization process that began in South Africa. It began in the United Kingdom in the late 80s under Margaret Thatcher. New Zealand was used as a test model way down there in the South Seas, where no one could see what was going on, as a country that went full-blown with privatization. Now, what did we call privatization? And it sounds good for private enterprise types. You know, that term didn't scare any of us. It didn't scare me back in 1990. But what did we call this in the Soviet Union? We called it perestroika.
Yeah, that's it, isn't it?
If there's any Russian words that we as Westerners, as your listeners know, it's perestroika, and of course the other one is glasnost.
Yeah, yeah.
Restructuring is privatization, is restructuring. Glasnost, of course, meaning openness, and then you've got a synonym of democracy, and it's the same kind of game that's being played in the United States. Basically what your globalists had been doing in the Third World before World War II, and in the Second World, countries like Argentina, after World War II, is now being done in the core Western countries, but you've had to have that preceded by really a propaganda war. No, they don't use language like that was used against people living in the Soviet Union. You use a different set of terminology before you begin to make the changes. Something we should know about as well, when South Africa was transitioning to your new government, shortly afterwards, currency controls began to be put in place so that people wanting to leave South Africa, we got a lot of doctors from South Africa that came over here to Canada. The same thing was implemented a couple years ago in the United States. Never made the mainstream media, of course, but nonetheless, this is what happened. And it's basically to prevent capital flight. And what you had in South Africa, what you had in the Soviet Union, is now going on in the United States. Make no mistake about it. It's all tied together. It's all tied together. It's just a matter of connecting the different parts. How do we look at it? You're basically looking at continuous variables in history. Some people think you need to have 100% of a story in order to have something useful to use, something to go forward with. It's not true. You only need about 75%, and you can determine pretty much what's going to happen next. We call this trend analysis. They use it in the stock market. That's what we're talking about.
Was the South African rand ever gold backed?
Yes, it was actually gold physically.
Yeah. This,
you had what were called your Kruger rands.
Yep.
Kruger rands, and this was before your paper money. Yes, it was gold, definitely, and we all know the value of that over fiat paper money.
Yeah, and we also know who's gold back now, don't we? That would be China and Russia. They're back in their ruble with gold now.
Absolutely. The Chinese wanting to become the Middle Kingdom again, I mean, China, Qin means middle, of course, are not going to be a second rate in what they're motoring up into as the world's leading economy right now. We're definitely going to see major changes that way. Maybe we would get into it in a further interview this way. But what's going on with China? You basically have your Soros types, your globalists, have decided that North America, Turtle Island for your indigenous listeners, is going to be deindustrialized, a breakdown of your middle class. All this talk you hear about, you know, change and democracy and middle class, we get this language up here in Canada. It's a mantra that the Prime Minister of Canada uses over and over, he and his government, the Trudeau government, of course, we're speaking about. It's not about money or wealth being shared between your working class and your middle class and your rich, and your rich sharing their huge amounts of wealth with people beneath them. It has nothing to do with that. We learned that from the South African example. What it is about is a shift of wealth from what has been a considerable middle class from after World War II upwards to a rich 1% elite, and they have decided China is going to be the new center of factories and industry. But where is North America still of interest and use to them? Because it still is, but not with industrial might and reality, but with oil, with gas, with energy resource extraction from the ground. This is still going to be a reality, even though we've heard for years about peak oil and downturns that way.
Oh, sure.
I believe it. It isn't the case.
This is amazing. I want to ask you something, and it's just it's not necessarily cogent to what you just said, but this Sukushka, yeah, Sukushka. Does that mean sequester?
No, it means psychological intimidation.
Oh, gotcha.
It's what the KGB used when they would take dissidents in the Soviet Union into, say, a psychiatric hospital to try to break people down.
You know, I understand that the Stasi, I'm writing down a couple, the reason that I'm writing here is... it probably appears rude, but I'm crafting a couple of questions I want to ask you after we conclude. I don't want to ask them to you while we're doing the program. You know, somebody's pushing this agenda awfully hard in this country. I've never seen such a minority get so much play. And they just won't stop. Can we single out a single sector, individual, or small group of people? You know, the deep state, the shadow government. First it was the shadow government. I guess since that got to be a popular term, I'm not so sure that the ones who run it didn't come up with their own title for themselves, because there's such hubris in that crew. I mean, we all know this. I think they probably came up with deep state.
John, it's not so much a group of people, you know, as to say in a smoke-filled room or such, where everything is 100% prefigured in this kind of way. It's more of a vision, more of a mentality, more of a perspective way of looking at the world and feeling, hey, we've got to bring things together. We've got to bring different regions of the world together. You've got a world parliament federation that's been in operation from years back, never got coverage in the mainstream media once again. So hence the reason we do the work we're doing here and why you have Caravan. Now, you have people who feel you're basically dealing with Skinner behavioralists. Now, I don't know how many of your listeners are familiar with your Walden 2, but for those of you who are, you're basically dealing with people who want to reinvent a society. They believe that not you, but they are the better ones to think out this new society. They're willing to go from scratch. They promise universal incomes, and they basically have people gravitated, usually through making it into a good-sounding idea, but bringing people into a group think. And in this, you're talking about getting people corralled into your big cities, your big metropolises, and off the land where people, of course, when they're on the land, you're on a ranch or something, they don't want that because people can grow their own food, they can live off the land, hunt, whatever it may be. So the name of the game, again, Skinner's Walden 2, what they were doing there is it was proposing a society where everybody is grouped into these cities that are like clones of one another, where they are monitored, the population is monitored, and again, they talk to you all your niceties, and you get all the foodstuffs that they manufacture. I mean, of course, you get images of your Soylent Green and what have you when you think about those sorts of things. I don't think we're talking the best kind of natural organic foods in talking about this, but this is what we're looking towards. Now, if you ask me, MC, what do you mean in a different way of speaking that way? We're basically talking about an elite. We're talking about globalists. We're talking about planners up at the top, just like you had those who were involved with the dismantling of South Africa and the Soviet Union. Again, convincing the local people there that this would be a good idea. It wasn't a forcing thing, but basically moving people into a direction, feeling they're the better thinkers in this large panorama, to basically turn your big cities in North America into Indian reservations.
Yep.
Now, if you keep in mind, you know your history, what happened with the corralling of American Indians into these reservations, you're on rations, and you're being watched, you can't move around freely on the land, you're talking about a propiska system being set up. You've got something that's part of your NAFTA reality that keeps getting pushed, but there never seems to be any news video coverage from inside of these meetings that have been held. We had one in Toronto in 2012, and they cordoned off the whole downtown of Toronto. It became a no constitution zone. There were police out there and checking people's backpacks, you know, to paint a scene for you there. But you're basically talking about an elite that says, okay, we're going to give you your stuff. We're going to make it nice. You're going to live on these, in these cities, reservations. And yet you want to travel to visit it. Another family member, say you're living in Chicago and you want to go to New Orleans, and you would normally say fly or head down the highway. Okay, we're not saying you're not going to have that sort of thing, but you've got already your no-fly lists, and when you travel down the highway, you're going to have to produce something that is called a US ID. Now, anyone who jokes about this saying, well, I saw that on some websites, I don't know if it's a real deal, kind of sounds like the Amero coin, and don't know if it's an actual physical thing that we're speaking about, haven't seen any proof. Look, you have a precedent already. In the Soviet Union, you had a propiska system. Propiska system is basically an internal passport system. That's what your U.S. ID proposal is. In the Soviet Union, if you wanted to travel from Moscow to Kiev or back and forth to visit family members, you had to show an internal passport. We're not talking a foreign passport to travel to the United States to be with some circus troupe or something like that, or some ballet. We're talking about just to travel within their own country. Soviet citizens had to carry an internal passport. That's what we're talking about here in the United States and in other parts of the Western world. You're basically looking at a Western world that, if you looked at a world map and saw a big part of the Western world and other parts in a blue color under your Facebook coloring, you're basically talking about you that have come on under this kind of mentality. So we're not talking a physical reality where you have these internal passports. You're talking about people being watched and monitored because of the grand extent digitally of social media. You know, you get these things where you report in on your Facebook and what have you, your telephone, your transponder. This is all old hat. you know about this already, but you're talking about an internal passport reality digitally by Facebook, other social media platforms being used in the United States, but it's only been sold on the good points. You know, you get criminals and they do bad things. We've got your, you know, of course, your Amber Alert. Somebody could grab a kid and what have you. But something to keep in mind about that is that may take care of, you know, your lone individual, maybe, and your street criminal types, and you're going, of course, we want to keep that under wrap. You know, if you're a woman and you don't want maniacs running around, you could think, well, why wouldn't you want to do this? Okay, let me share this with you. In the early days of the Soviet Union, your early Soviet government under Stalin, you had somebody by the name of Leverentia Beria, and he was the head of the NKVD, the KGB, basically.
And
what he did, John, I don't know if you're familiar with this or your listeners this way, but let's just look at this anyways as a refamiliarization. Leverentia Beria, all the power and influence and resources of one who's the head of the KGB this way, used to go around Moscow at nighttime in a limousine and pick up young women. Just snatch them off the street. Now, if you've got a criminal civilian kind of way of thinking, somebody and they grab some woman this way, okay, at least there you find out about it. People in the neighborhood find out about it. A search is put out. You can involve the police. But what happens when the people doing the grabbing, the kidnapping, are themselves the police, and even worse, the secret police?
Well, this is the strongest argument for getting rid of the Second Amendment, isn't it?
Well, if you have a disarmed population, now again, we don't have a Second Amendment here in Canada like you do there in the United States, but we understand the value of it full well. You've got people who don't agree with it, and they present their points for that, and people, of course, who think we should have that sort of thing here in Canada this way. And of course, you have the Swiss example and other parts of Europe where you're familiar with European countries where the population is armed, as in contrast to those European countries where people are not armed. Now, I should mention this, with all of the refugee movements basically being brought into Western Europe, Chancellor Merkel, all of these changes, the Brussels giving full permission for this, and of course at the behest of local politicians as well. This isn't done in secret. We all see this. The Eastern European governments, the Czech Republic, Hungary, Poland, Slovakia, realized right away, keep in mind, what they were dealing with this way. Now, why is this? Why do you have this opening of a door with Western Europe and people not saying, hey, hold on a second, we don't think we should be doing this, this isn't a good idea? Why do the Eastern Europeans in this bloc, they're called the Visegrad Four, why have they said, no, we're not for this, stop, we're not going to take any of your forced refugees? Well, these countries can smell a game. They can smell deception miles away. They had to live under communism, where you basically had liars in government for years. So they can smell this sort of thing, John, at a great distance, and wanted nothing to do with it. They immediately raised their borders and put their border troops on their borders with Western European countries like Germany, something that might be a good idea on the U.S.-Mexican border. We're dealing with realities on the U.S.-Canadian border with concern to the Edmonton terror suspect in reality up here, refugee, come across the border, was going to be deported by U.S. Authorities, ends up fleeing to Canada. We can speak about that, but what happened, where we're at with the Eastern European countries, they said, sorry, we're not going to do this. And now viewers may not be aware of this, John, but you've got a lot of critical steps, big things that are happening. The Czech citizenry is arming right now and are prepared to do battle should Brussels make another move to force refugees on the Czech Republic, which they, of course, call Czechia now. Their new name is Czechia.
Right.
So you're looking at people who are asleep, namely in the West, and people who are awake, namely in the East, because they've had a good hard taste with dictatorship, with games, with, in this sense, communism, and they don't want anything more to do with that. Now, our mainstream media may still label them as communists, but John, this is not where people's minds are at. Again, you mentioned earlier, and with my time in the former Soviet Union, teaching students, I had students from all over the former Soviet Union, from Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Belarus, Russia, Ukraine, you name it, all over. And for over 10 years, seeing where their minds are at, do they really believe stuff from the Soviet Union? And of course, you had some differences. The older generation, they were a lot more well-behaved in the classroom. The younger ones, 14, 15, 16 years old, no memory of the Soviet Union. A lot more talkative, gregarious, you know, like their equivalent Western students. This is how it is. But we're asking ourselves, where are we at? We've got language that is being used by our mainstream media, by the corporate media, by the controlled media, saying we're making these changes. It's the normal thing to do because we don't want to be racist. It has nothing to do with racism. It has nothing to do with this. And your leaders in Eastern Europe and Russia, they see this and they're calling out Western politicians, the State Department, others, on their language. They know exactly what's going on. Their special services can monitor our media. It's not just WikiLeaks cables and such. You have intelligence networks in Eastern Europe, just like the way the French intelligence did. They could listen into stuff from the United States, see what was going on. If what was being said by the State Department was not the case, the French could call them out on it. Same thing, John.
You know, for a time, it's very intriguing that you lived in the desert, in the Sinai desert, between Egypt and Israel back in the day. Do you mind telling us when you were living there and any experience you may have with jihadis? I understand Vladimir Putin has had some problems with jihadis himself in Russia, but, you know, look, the news we get over here, that's why I started this organization, because I'm not real happy with the news that we get from mainstream media at all. So that is why we are here. What about that going to the desert for a while?
Well, basically, John, for your... what's going on with some time spent, I don't know how I ended up out in the desert. I just did. I actually was looking to go and do some teaching in Alexandria in Egypt, of course, up on the Mediterranean Sea. And I didn't end up going there, but I ended up spending time in the Sinai Desert. I was, well, to paint a picture, about 2 miles away inside of Israel, 2 miles away from the Egyptian border. Now, at the time that I was there, this was back in 2012, you basically had a number of things happening simultaneously. One, the Egyptian Mubarak government had just collapsed and was in a process of breakdown. The Egyptian army was not in control of the Sinai Peninsula. You had chaos. You had chaos. People were, they didn't know what was going on.
And did anybody happened, have control of it? Did anybody?
Well, what happened is jihadi groups ended up taking control of the peninsula because the Egyptian army was so busy trying to take care of matters and all the changes taking place in Cairo and elsewhere that they kind of let their hand off what was happening in Sinai. And of course, this alerted things up high on the Israeli side, wondering what was going to happen with Egypt. I mean, of course, you have the Islamic Brotherhood, big vote coming in, bringing them into government, basically popular vote this way, a lot to be said. But for people, what was going on in the desert this way, I was sleeping in kind of a little crag so I could get a bit of protection from the sun. I had people asking me, well, what was the temperature like there? It was 50 above Celsius anyways. We're basically well over 100, 105, 100. I mean, it was just crazy. But here's the thing. After I was there a couple weeks, I didn't even think about the sun or the temperature anymore. It was the dust. The dust was so real. It was so bothering of your inside. You're breathing it in your nose. You're taking it in your mouth. Your mouth is coated with it. It's not like sand like we have in the Arizona desert or something. It's a very fine powder. And when it goes inside of you, you're wondering, how can I get it out? And you can't get it out. So you're perpetually tasting it. It almost drives you out of your skin, John. But what do? It's there, and you just have to get mentally used to it, just like you have to the extreme temperatures, the sunshine, and yes, of course, dry heat, so it's better than the most. But when I was there, changes began to take place, and you began to have jihadi groups carrying RPGs, missile launchers, beginning to fire over the Egyptian-Israeli border into small towns, little communities, Moshavim and such, in the south of Israel, around the Gaza area specifically. They weren't the big kind that you could hit Tel Aviv with or anything. These just shorter range, but they were firing over. So there was a big concern there. How long is it going to take before the Egyptian army regains control of the Sinai Peninsula? I can remember all kinds of Israeli jeeps and trucks just roaring down the highway headed towards the border with Egypt, supplies coming in this way. But at nighttime, I would go for a walk. Often I couldn't sleep. It was just too hot. So I'd go for a walk and try and get any bit of breeze to cool my body down. Now, I mentioned several things happening at this time. You had Sudanese men and women, children, walking up through Egypt to Israel from Sudan, walking, you're talking like 1,500 miles through desert, through scrub, through bush, trying to get to Israel for refuge, nicer country to live, basically was in people's minds. They had heard stories, but most had never been to Israel before. And what was going on is, I mean, I heard stuff. I had to lean in because I was wondering if I had heard right. You had people during that journey north through Sudan, through Egypt, who were being eaten by lions in the desert. I'm like,
wow.
What do you say to that when people say that to you? They say that one of their nephews got eaten by a lion.
Yeah, all I could say then was wow.
Now, when these Sudanese refugees reached the Israeli border, of course, you're probably aware there's a border fence there, and we can understand reasons for fences being constructed. You have the Israeli soldiers on one side, the Egyptian army on the other, eventually regaining control over a period of time, but yet still parts of the Sinai Desert, jihadi groups operating. It's a big area of terrain and geography. You can't just deal with everybody in one moment this way. But a lot of the refugees trying to cross made it up within sight of the fence and wanted to make a run, a dash towards the fence to get over. And the Egyptian army were firing at them. And what began to happen is Israeli soldiers began to call out in Arabic to the Egyptian soldiers saying, if you shoot them, we'll shoot you. Let them cross. So there was a sympathy there at that time. Long story, Sudanese began to settle. There's a couple towns in the south and Tel Aviv. Lots of refugees this way, trying to make sense of what's going on. Many of them have never been in a city before. You'd walk around in towns and cities in Israel, and sometimes the largest groups of people you saw on the street were people from Sudan. There were also Eritreans there as well. Ethiopians had already been in Israel. But the reason we're speaking about this is you get a refugee population that is like, look, we're happy to be here. We agree with the body politic of your country. We come in peace. My heart on this, John, is I don't have a problem with that. I can work with that. It's when you start to get people coming over claiming refugee status that are trying to strike at your country from within, that's where you're dealing with issues. That's where questions need to be asked. That's where we need to do further research. And our mainstream media is not covering that. It's all kind of the good smiley side of the details, leaving out the others that viewers aren't getting. So you have refugees, the ones that are genuine, there's no problem this way. But if they're coming in and their intent is on violence, it's the job of a government to do something about that. I think this is just common sense.
Yeah, you would think. Common sense. Wow. It's become an oxymoron now because it's so uncommon. Let me ask you this. Can you estimate what percentage of the total number of refugees coming in from the Middle East, let's just say the Middle East, are legitimate refugees, and how many of them, what percentage of them can we just guess?
Maybe 25%.
On their minds.
Maybe 25%. It's like the numbers given in the mainstream media talking about Syrian refugees coming in. Only 25% of the refugees coming in to Europe in that sense are actually Syrian. You have others coming in that mix, not Syrian. They're from Afghanistan. You've got people from Kosovo. You have Turks who kind of just blend in with the streams of people coming up into Europe. Now, those who have been brought over in airlift to the United States, Canada, a little different. There's a little bit more vetting, not enough in the minds of some people who are doing deeper research into refugee transitions and opening the borders and such. I mean, it really begs a question. If, as we had out of the Iraqi war going way back, Afghanistan, as we were told by governments in the West that we have a war on terror, if you have a war on terror, if it's really a war on terror, you don't keep your borders open. You don't have an open border policy in effect in your country. How in the world can you see who's come in and what's going on the ground? It doesn't, that anybody should be able to see that. But of course, we've got things going on where only half the story is being told.
I know maybe you do know, but even if you don't know, what can we theorize is the reason, other than completely destabilizing Western civilization?
Well, let me say this first, John. When I was living in France, I spent a large amount of time with people coming in. There's a large French Arabic community, and you're dealing with different people. You've got people there, they're great. There's no problem. We would go for coffee. It's cool. But those are usually people who didn't have a Quranic stronghold on their hearts. And when we speak Quran, I'm not speaking exclusively just about reading surahs from the Quran. We're speaking about other teachings, other understandings, the hadith, the sunnah, the qiyas. We're speaking about all of this when we speak about that. So that needs to be understood. For most persons who didn't operate with this, they're just simply saying, for example, that they're Muslims, but it's kind of more just Muslim because they were born Muslim. They don't really hold to this stuff. They want to be French. No problem really with that group of people. You've got other neighborhoods, what you call in France, bars and towers neighborhoods, where the government is just simply let those areas, those suburbs, those arrondissements in the north of Paris, Lyon, other cities where it's a war zone. The police won't go in there. Let me just say a quick story, an illustration for you. I had asked at some point, do you have police and firefighters that go into these areas? Because I've heard that you don't have them going in there. And a roommate of mine, he was a pianist, he said to me, look, you've had police go in there and you get a big high-rise tower and they'll pull up to the base of the building, answering some like equivalent of a 911 call. And some people way up on the 20th floor will tip a refrigerator off their balcony. The thing comes down and it caves the roof of the police car in. Everybody in there is dead. So you've got this thing going on where police, people on the street, they don't want to be near any of this. The issue is with your elites that are calling the shots, who are pouring people in. They shove them in certain neighborhoods. But you can understand, as they begin to spill over the cup, over the rim, you begin to have problems with the other people who are living in their immediate vicinity this way. Now, something happened with the Gaddafi government when he was still alive and in power. Now, of course, your listeners know about the whole gold dinar story and he wanted to make a currency for Africa. I won't speak on that. That's well known. But basically, Gaddafi was told by your European elite, look, you're the wall. We don't want the people coming up from Africa. This is the crazy, weird thing about it. You're the wall. You hold these people back. And here you go. Now, Gaddafi, it is said, blackmailed the European elite, your Brussels, your others, your syndicates. And he said, okay, I want 5 billion euros a year to do your job for you. And what Gaddafi was doing is he was taking black Africans that were coming up into Libya on behest of the European elites, not the governments on the prime minister level, above that, and taking them in trucks back out south into the Libyan desert and just dumping them there. We're talking about people whose bodies later on are found bleached white. So this was going on. The deal went bad between Gaddafi and the European elites, and he was removed. Now, this is the same thing that you had happen in Serbia. NATO was used by your elites, this upper floor I mentioned before, your NATO, your IMF, your World Bank, your State Department, they're all on the same floor of the building, like your banks and your insurance companies are on the same floor of the building. They went in, they used NATO to pound Serbia, and they used word games like they're doing now, saying, well, the Serbians, they're communists and they're creating atrocities against the Bosnian Muslims that are there, the Croats and what have you. Now, some of that is true. We know we have graveyards. It was true. But they were all Yugoslavians before. They were all on an equal footing. All the people that were in a position of influence all had Communist Party influence. I mean, to be fair with Yugoslavia, you had a really nice society. It was kind of like a soft socialism under Tito. It wasn't like what you had in the rest of Eastern Europe, East Germany and such, much harder, and especially not further east into the Soviet Union. Basically, the further east you went, the harder life got, the more quote-unquote medieval people's conditions were. That's what you had there. But what was done in Serbia was done afterwards with Libya and has been going on in recent years to bring down the Syrian government. Now, a lot of people wonder, how do we fit the refugee thing in with the bombing of these countries? How do the two fit together? Well, this is where you begin to get into your Euro-Mediterranean Union. Okay? So we're not talking about the European Union anymore. Just like there used to be a European Economic Community, now that's passé. Well, the European Union is passé. Your elites have new plans for the continent, or you might say continents, They just haven't told anybody. They just simply, okay, we're moving on to the next stage. Now, for those who are willing to do research, for the person who is willing to go deeper into it, you have the documents there, the PDFs. They have been put up by different departments of the European Union for years. This isn't something that there's no information on. You can go online right now. You can look at it yourself, all of their security proposals. But the plan is to integrate the former European Union with North Africa and the Middle East. So we're basically calling North Africa and the Middle East MENA, M-E-N-A as an acronym, and it is being merged together stage by stage with the European Union. Now, your European elites, remember, keep in mind, again, we're dealing with Skinner behavioralists. They're kind of looking at it. They realize, they say, okay, we understand. You know, you get your honest question askers at the board meeting saying, won't this create problems with people on the street and in the neighborhoods and people living here, are French, are Germans. Now your higher ups go, yes, it will, but later on, it's going to be better because we're going to mix people together. We're going to bring people from North Africa and the Middle East into Europe, and we are going to just blend things together. We're going to make it one economic union. And it's going to be rougher, but we're going to bring things together socially and culturally as well. Right now, of course, that isn't working out very well. That's what we're feeling. We've got the kickback. But obviously, we're still dealing with issues where people have wool over their eyes because they've voted Angela Merkel back into office. You've got other European governments and MEPs who are awake to this, people like Geert Wilders and others, Nigel Farage, who are awake to this, but it's still a process to wake up their populations respectively.
You realize that you've just blown their cover. You have just revealed the answer to the question that has been dogging me and many other people for a long time. Who is doing this and why? And now we bloody well know. You're telling me there's a European Mediterranean Union that's planned now? What other reason can there be for flooding Western Europe with these people?
Well, I asked myself like all of you listening, for years I thought, what insane government would allow all kinds of refugees, unvetted, most of them military-age males? We've all seen the lines on CCTV of streams of military-age men coming in the countryside, moving up through southeastern Europe, through Turkey, coming in. Who in their right mind would allow for an opening of doors this way and such? And you think, well, it doesn't make sense for any straight mind this way. But of course, we have to remember we are dealing with Skinner behavioralists, and they're willing to let there be pain and adjustment and stretching in the short term, because in the long term, they believe this is going to make things good all around for most people. They're just going to have to take some time to get used to it. And of course, that's exactly what different European leaders like Macron, Merkel, what they've been talking about. And they're being called out in the European Parliament. Keep in mind, even though the European Parliament is an elected body, it's kind of like a Senate in some countries. It really doesn't have a lot of power. Your power really is vested at your European Commission level. Now, what are we looking at with the European Commission this way? You're not dealing with a bunch of politicians who are just hired on and given a salary and they do their thing for 4 or 5 years. Your European Commission people are basically a board of directors. Now, keep in mind, I want to say this and bring this in on the side as well. Even though we look at the Soviet Union as having been communist, you know, not into private enterprise, whatever, the Politburo that you had governing the Soviet Union was in fact a board of directors, and they were running a corporation, albeit a poorly run corporation, but a corporation with a board of directors nonetheless. But the European Commission, the people that are sitting on it, are basically your people up at the top of your leading supranational corporations in the European Union. You're dealing with shareholders whose main interest and prime interest is not the integrity of a national state or the sovereignty of those states in question.
So in other words, the only sovereignty there's going to be are these various unions that they're trying to set up.
Well, this is it. They're setting up economic blocks, and they shift them around, and they change the name from time to time. You got your CETA, of course, between the European Union and Canada and ASEAN and what have you. They change the names. They update it a bit. And, you know, if the old name gets a bad image. But the end goal is the same, and that's to basically shift national sovereign countries away from their own independence, like you've had with South Africa, like you've had with the former Yugoslavia. Again, beautiful country, but we can't have that doing its own thing right in the middle of Europe. So we're going to have to cause a war, collapse them, basically provoking people from the inside in order to turn their guns on their neighbors. Sound familiar?
Sounds familiar.
We don't want that to happen in the United States. Now, you have this argument, well, it's complicated. This, what we have really is not some simple thing that we can just say a few easy words with and provide a whole bunch of answers that are covering everything all in one day. It doesn't work that way. You have a reality where we look at what's happening right now in the United States, polarization. You had the same thing, John, happening in Yugoslavia. You had your interests from the outside, your NATO, your IMF, your World Bank coming in from the outside, your State Department. What do? They do what they do each time. They name a bad guy. In this case, it was the Serbians. And after the Serbian army did its damage against their neighbors, the outside powers said, okay, they've done enough. You got enough chaos in that country. Now we're going to move in with NATO's UMPAFOR soldiers, your blue helmets, and we're going to occupy the country. We don't want that to happen in the United States. So we have to be very careful with the kind of choices we're making, the decisions we're putting into action, steps were taken. We have neighbors. All of us want peace. None of us advocate violence. We want things to be good all around for as many people as possible. But at the same time, we can't be naive as to what's going on. For example, you have kind of like a kid playing in a sandbox and a bully comes along. The little kid doesn't like it and he says, I want you to just leave me alone. I'm playing in the sand here, doing my own thing. I'm not bothering you. Well, that bully isn't going to keep away just because that other little kid there doesn't like the bully being around. You have to deal with that bully. And if the bully is armed, you have to understand you're not dealing with people who are simply coming and wanting to have a conversation or dialogue with you. That's very important for us to understand. Now, the connection we have in speaking about Putin continually in the news, Russia continually in the news, what I've found is if I take what the mainstream media has been declaring and I move at 180 degrees, very often I find what they are accusing their opposition of, they are carrying out themselves. That's just for the lazy propaganda part of it. There's more sophisticated parts, but that's the lazy propaganda level that we're looking at with this here. Now, why this long Russian narrative? First, we know it's been very convenient. The Democratic Party was embarrassed. They had to explain a loss of election. But in speaking about, okay, like we have someone, your average American, haven't traveled much. What is it really like over there? Do those Ruskies, are they still against us? Now, keep something in mind. In the 90s, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, just kind of being a bit of a memory repository for us for a moment, if I might, after the Soviet Union collapsed and we were dismantling their ICBMs. You had American technicians going into Kazakhstan and what have you. You had your big launch site there at the Baikonur Cosmodrome, and all this dismantling was going on. It was like we were making friends. The Russians were our friends in the 1990s going into the millennial decade. Yet all of a sudden, coming through the presidential election, all of a sudden, all these words and communications come out and the Russians are our enemy. And people out there picking them up and saying, well, the Russians must be the enemy because the media is telling us so. Well, hold on a second. If they were our friends yesterday and now they're not, shouldn't you be asking questions as to why we have this abrupt change all of a sudden? Would you do that if you had a neighbor in your neighborhood?
Is it because Russia's in the way? Is it because they want to maintain their sovereignty? What is it? Why are they the bad guy again?
Well, the Russians, unlike years in the past, are awake to what happened to them during the Russian Revolution, the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917. And again, we mentioned earlier, we're dealing with the anniversary of that same revolution right now this month. And believe me, it's going to be used on the street. And maybe I don't need to say, but I think you know already what kind of groups are going to be put onto the concrete using this revolution, Russian Revolution, as a touch point to drive people out there. And I wish it weren't so, but I think with violence. And we're speaking Antifa, we're speaking groups that, I mean, can just be really conjured up. Okay, let me give you an example this way for your listeners, John. During the Orange Revolution in Ukraine, which was a color revolution, a Soros color revolution, but just kind of in your light form, your Euromaidan 2012, 2013, 14, because it took place over a period of time. It wasn't just the 2 weeks with the cameras there. That was when things went to a heavier state. You had an incremental attempt to bring Ukraine into the Western fold. And again, you've got your prime minister salesmen, and they all do their bid and say what they're supposed to on television and talk all the good points and all the good side, not telling people what this is going to involve, the pain, the cost this way, no surprise. But this reality on the street with the Russian Revolution anniversary upon us now, the word is going to be these private enterprisers, they're not going to say it in language like these robber baron capitalists, because nobody wants that kind of stuff. That's not who we are. We don't want to be governed by people like that. We're not talking about a Carnegie level type of thing that they're going to use as words of advance. We're talking about a reality where they're going to speak about their opposition, those who don't believe in the sovereignty of the United States, and say, you've got these other people in the country. Yeah, they're going to be talking conservative language, these groups of people and stuff, Trump kind of people, what have you, liberty people, constitution people, all of these same synonyms that you always see in the same sentence, and speak about these groups of people in that they are the people with the money, the associations with colonialism. Now, you had the same thing go on in the birth, in the nascence of the Soviet Union when Lenin was alive. When Lenin was standing up there, what was he saying? He was saying, these people, these kulaks, these rich peasants, they have all the money. You go, you take their homes, you take their cows, and then everything will be made nice and equal. But you got to understand, there's games that are played in this. Lenin had something you might remember called the New Economic Policy from about 1921 to 1923, where he actually allowed some private enterprise on the ground, because during Trotsky's war communism campaign, Trotsky being the founder of the Red Army, they were doing so much damage on the ground, people retracting, not trading, buying and selling this way, that your Bolsheviks were running out of cash. So they needed to get an injection this way. So, of course, they said, okay, we're going to let you do a little small plot business. You can do your own thing. And, of course, they just scoop from that. Now, something very interesting here where there's correlation between the Soviet Union of a few years later, 1933, the 30s, really, and the 30s in the United States when FDR was in power. In the Soviet Union, they had something, we were speaking about gold earlier on, something called Torgsin. These were special shops that existed in the Soviet Union. I don't know if we've heard about these, where if you somehow, some way had some foreign currency or some gold, maybe from a relative overseas who mailed it to you, you could go into these specialty shops and buy fancy Western goods that your average Soviet citizen, former Russian, could not get their hands on. Now, at the same time, there was a gold confiscation, a removing of gold from people, of course, using these Torgsin shops. Here, come in here, trade in your gold jewelry, and we'll give you food and what have you, and your family will eat and survive. And of course, you'll remember at the same time, 1933, a law passed by FDR's government, same time, making the private ownership of gold illegal. I think it's very important for our listeners to remember that correlation.
This is astounding. It really is. You have filled in so many blanks. I'm just delighted. This is most unexpected. I knew it was going to be interesting.
Well, it's deeper than that, John. It's deeper than that. You basically, now, when I was growing up, like many of our listeners in North America, you kind of had this understanding that everybody in the Soviet Union under communism, and again, a lot of this is known in history books. You can read it or read a PDF online, whatever. That part you can read by yourself. What I'm talking about here didn't get in those books. A lot of people in the West thought under communism, everybody's under a socialist system and there's no rich people and everything. Now we know, of course, all of your communist elite, very important to understand the picture here. They had their own villas, their own big dacha houses. You've heard about these, but they were basically running a state within a state. They had their own. Now, I'll give you a picture of what this is. Shortly after I arrived in Kiev, I was walking around different neighborhoods, going into places that you could not go into as a Western person. You can't go into these buildings now because they've put electronic, well, magnetic locks on the doors. You can't go into them. But the locks were broken by kids living in the buildings, and the doors were swinging on the hinges and blowing in the wind. So when I arrived, I was exploring the city and seeing how higher levels of Communist Party people and their families were living. Now, to explain, in the Soviet Union and after the breakup of the Soviet Union, people who were in higher party levels and KGB levels married each other. You had like kind of like families, clans, we call them over there, going on, where people would marry each other's daughters and sons to one another. And they would live, they'd have their own apartment buildings. You'd have apartment buildings for bus drivers and people working in this kind of factory. And so you had apartment buildings exclusively for KGB and party family members. Now, I went exploring in them, and now it's quite interesting. At the time, your regular buildings where your average person lived, they might make it a little nice inside their own apartments this way, but out in the hallways, it always smelt like urine, just stunk. Elevators broken, no repair. Basically, it's like this, John. Nobody deloused the apartment buildings for 10 years.
Oh, is that
10 years, there was no cleaning. People, it was a foulness. You could have a working elevator in the building you were living in, but you never knew quite if the cables were going to work.
Wow.
Some people just, I would come home from work and I would go up the staircase, and of course, pitch darkness, Why? Because people, you know, having no money to live on, they didn't have money for, you know, their own utilities, and they were stealing the light bulbs from the hallways, and I had to feel my way upstairs, coming home from work, going up the building, and kind of wonder to myself, am I on this floor? Am I on the, I had to count. And for the first bit, I'd go out into the hallway opening the door, and I'd look and realize, oh, I'm on the wrong floor. I got to go one down or one up. So that's what you had to live with. But in these apartment buildings where your Communist Party elite were living, oh, they had beautiful mirrors in the hallways. You had paintings in places. It was like a different world. But when you're on the outside looking at the apartment buildings, they look just like one of about five apartment styles that they built in the Soviet Union. You couldn't tell one from the other. Only when you go inside were you really beginning to see what life was truly like.
So it's just like I've been saying. The fat cats, the ones at the top, live well. They got the best places to live. They got the nicest cars. They got the nicest girls. They've got it all.
Well, in the United States, you could go, you know, people, of course, you buy things, you have wealth, and, you know, what you've earned or not earned, you can have in the open this way. But in the Soviet Union, with your communist elite, they had their own market economy stuff going on at the same time as the rest of the population was living on gray bread and borscht soup to eat. They had their own tennis courts. I was walking, I went into courtyards behind the apartment buildings that you couldn't see from the street. I'm looking around, I'm like, I can't believe this. They have tennis courts. And in the Soviet Union, you couldn't just go walking in these places because the security guards on duty or the militia, the police, there would say, what are you doing? Are you supposed to be here? And unless you could show a special, what was called a red card, you couldn't go into these areas. So you'd stay in your one area, you worked in a factory, they kept you busy and tied down in that place. That was most of your day. You're there, whatever, like 10 hours a day anyways, at least eight. And the government, the Soviet government, didn't want people to see other parts of the Soviet Union lest they find out the way other people were really living across the breadth of the USSR. Now, a lot of that is known, but in going inside of it, you basically had people, their minds didn't know what to do with this, even after the collapse. Now, when I arrived, you had a lot of business people, John, who started up businesses. They started up their own small businesses. It could be a beauty salon or a cafe or something. A lot of them were murdered or had their partners murdered because the mafia was operating everywhere. I've got a lawyer friend, and he was very brainy, and some street mafia took him and used him for years. Like, it's almost like he couldn't walk away from it, and told him, you're going to do this, you're going to do that. Now, I'll mention something, if I might, about this fellow. His name was, we'll call him Bogdan, and he ended up starting his own law practice over the course of time. Now, during the Orange Revolution, you had your parliament operating, and I saw that he had a new phone, and I thought, did somebody give that to you? I mean, it was expensive at that time for your regular person to buy a cell phone. And he was working for a KGB office, and he had found something out just the other day about something going on with members of parliament. And this, you might want to lean in a bit for this. Bogdan found out that there were members inside of the parliament that were running prostitution rings of children out of orphanages in that country. And one of the kids that he had met said, please, can you help me with this? This is what they're doing. And he thought, well, and he went home and he was thinking, what do I do with this? And he ends up making the phone call to his employer, KGB officer, And he starts to talk away about it and says, look, I had this kid. This is what he told me. This is what he says is going on in this place. And the KGB officer, the SBU, said, stop right there. Don't talk about this. They will kill you. So you had this going on, something further. Well, I guess, okay, we'll speak about this. You have a cosmetology business that was growing in the former Soviet Union, basically beauty product industry, creams, what have you. What are they using inside of these creams?
I'm guessing it's something human.
They're using material from aborted fetuses in order to create properties within the cream to, let's say, buff up the skin of women using these products. What do you do when you hear a story like that?
Well, what I'm doing now, just kind of sitting here in a somewhat semi-stunned silence.
Now, with the Orange Revolution, a question gets asked, and it might be a question, I think it is with your listeners. I heard something, there's more. What is the difference with what happened in Ukraine with the Orange Revolution and the Euromaidan that we heard about? Basically, what happened with the Orange Revolution is it caused a national awakening inside of many Ukrainians to stand up, to begin to leave behind an earlier slave mentality where they were afraid of government, their government, afraid of asking questions of their government, and begin to come out onto the streets. Now, one asks, did you have something happen there from the outside, or did you have something happen with actual Ukrainians on the street level? You had both happen at the same time. Again, one is the micro level, one is the macro level. You had people, Ukrainians on the street, they wanted to have their own country. They're interested in sovereignty in their own land. At the same time, you had people come in from the time of the Orange Revolution to Euromaidan, basically your Western elite, and say, we're going to bring them into our orbit this way. I'll give you an example. Back in 2000, I was in a cafeteria in downtown Kyiv, and I sat down and I saw a fellow in uniform come up. He was an officer with the army of a NATO country, and he asked if he could sit. I actually kind of used my body language to signal him over. The place was crowded. There was nowhere else to sit. So he sat down with my friend and I, and he ended up telling us, long and short, that we asking, what are you doing here? And seeing his badge and uniform this way, dark green. What are you doing here? Are you? Because when you're in Ukraine at that time, you had people coming, you had Peace Corps people, NGOs, diplomats, you name it. So you kind of get used to that sort of crowd. What does he say? He says, we're here to retrain Ukraine's conscript army into a smaller volunteer army. You had your Western elites, your Liverpoolers, involved in Ukraine to bring it out of the Russian orbit into the Western orbit before the Orange Revolution, and especially before, years before Euromaidan. Why is this important to mention? Because what was put on our Western news media, our mainstream media this way, was this line that you have an uprising on the street, which you did, the people were still there, but it basically was piggybacked on by your State Department, by your higher levels, and now we're going to bring Ukraine over in the same way we did earlier on with Georgia. We're going to bring them inside, but in order to do so and work this way, we have to paint the Russian Federation in a certain manner. And this narrative with Russia was picked up again with the presidential election in the United States. just with some tweaks and adjustments, but the same kind of narrative being used. The Russians that were our friends yesterday are now the bad guys.
Wow. This is really something. You know, I'd long suspected some of this, but to hear you explain it like this, I'm not going to even ask you how you know this. I will not ask that question. And if you volunteer it, I'll edit it out for your own good.
Basically, John, what was going on is I asked a question that your listeners ask. People, since the breakup of the Soviet Union, living over in that part of the world, were there in Kiev. You've got people coming and going every day from Moscow. People have family all over Russia, in other countries of the former Soviet Union. It's not like because Ukraine is a country, Russia is a country, that they're now hermetically sealed. People are traveling on the trains every day, 50 trains. They're moving all the time. And you get news back and forth this way. Now, the question is asked, where are people's mindsets? Are they still thinking like they want communism again? What do they want to do? We'll jump right up here, if I might, to the matter of Crimea. This was put on in our mainstream news in the Western world and outside elsewhere. What happened with Crimea? You had the Russians move in, take over. What actually happened there? I used to spend a lot of time down in Crimea in the mountains. Not a long train trip from Kiev. People would go down there. Everybody in Kiev has a second house in Crimea. So what you've got down there is basically the Russians understanding what your Western elite has been doing for a long time, saying, look, we can wait for the West to move through the putsch government that they've installed in Kiev to do their thing. They're going to repossess the naval base and facilities, the ships we have at Sevastopol. We can wait for this to happen. Now you think, this is not one side or the other siding with one side or the other. If you were the Russians and you saw this coming and you knew it was going to take place, what are they going to do? Just sit back? So knowing what was being built up, that you had a government installed in Kiev, in which there were foundations laid for years in advance, as we've just spoken about, the Russians went in, the people in Crimea voted. Keep this in mind. The majority of the population ethnically in Russia, in Crimea, are not Ukrainians. They're ethnic Russians, with the minority of Tatar people, whom we call Mongols in the West. The Russians are the majority ethnically already. Before the Russians went into Crimea, there was a referendum in Sevastopol and throughout Crimea. The capital, of course, is in Simferopol. The majority of the people there are Russian speakers. They were basically of the heart. Even before any of this began, how is it that we were never a part of Russia anyways? I mean, with your general knowledge and history, Crimea was given away by Khrushchev in 1954. Some say it was over when he was drunk, but he gave away the Crimean Peninsula to Ukraine. It was joined to Ukraine. It wasn't historically part of Ukraine. Ukrainians have never been a majority of the people living in Crimea. That's something that your viewers need to understand.
And he gave it away to who?
They gave it to Khrushchev when he was general secretary of the Soviet Union in the Soviet Union back in 1953, gave away the Crimean Peninsula to Ukraine, the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic.
Okay. Well, is it true that Crimea is actually rather rustic and a lot of retired Russian generals go live there? Is that true or is that just myth?
Everybody goes down there.
Gotcha.
I used to go down there with my friends all the time. Everybody's got a beach house. This is where you go, the warm weather. People travel by train from Siberia to come and hang out on the beach in the summer in Crimea. And it's everybody, not just important people, regular people who only have a few bucks in their pocket too. Everybody goes down there, and it was a normal part of Soviet life. So the people living there came into these interruptions, were thrown off their feet, kind of like somebody slamming the brakes on one of these trains. You're thrown off your feet, your body lands in the hallway on the train, and you're wondering what's going on. That, in essence, is what happened with the breakup of the Soviet Union. You had people, John, when the ruble collapsed at the end of the Soviet Union, who stared out the windows of their apartments for 2 weeks, catatonic, and didn't move. And their grandkids would come up and shake them, and they wouldn't look at the grandkid. They were just staring out the window. You had people with lots of money, fair amounts of money in their bank accounts. You did have people with money in the Soviet Union. The problem was there just wasn't anything on the shelves to buy. It's kind of a joke that the only thing on the shelf, even when there's nothing, is baklazhan ikra. It's like eggplant in jars. People ate, they had rubles, but there was nothing to buy it on, unless, of course, you were one of these higher Communist Party types that went in one of these torsion shops that we mentioned. But the people were basically woken up out of a dream, maybe a nightmare, some would say it. And yet, before things became reorganized in Ukraine and Russia for stability, people had that 10-year period where they didn't know who they were. Are we Soviets? Are we Russians? Are we Ukrainians? What are we? Many of them just didn't want to deal with it. So they sold apartments. They got together some money. They got a visa, and they went to the United States or Australia, Canada, somewhere else, and they just wanted to forget all of this. But the people that did stay took years to reorganize themselves. Now, I'll mention this. When Putin first came to power in his first term, he didn't do anything. He kind of sat and watched the situation, just watching. Yeltsin was drunk during his term, and the former Soviet Union was being run by oligarchs. We all know this. And they used to meet in a place called the Green Room. And that's where big oval table, and basically during Yeltsin's time, the oligarchs came in and basically just not so much as suggestions, told Yeltsin what they were going to do with the running of the country. The oligarchs had used something which is well known called the loans for shares arrangement, where they bought a whole bunch of big former state companies for not a lot of money, and they put their hands on it. So they were running the show, and then Putin comes into power. He doesn't do anything. He watches them. But then when he comes in his second term, he calls them all into a new room called the Red Room in the Kremlin, not St. Basil's, as you see often in social media, where they show that, you know, multicolored, you know, those cupolas, those domes, and they, speaking of that, is the Kremlin. That's not the Kremlin. That's St. Basil's Cathedral. So that's a misunderstanding that's there sometimes on the news. But with the Kremlin, they would meet inside, and Putin basically leaned back, and it was quite funny if you knew what was going on, because the state television cameras would zoom in behind Putin on a picture on the wall, which Russians, of course, call icons, and there would be an icon behind him, and they'd kept flicking back and forth to this. And if you're maybe a Western viewer or a non-Russian viewer, you'd kind of wonder why they're doing that. You kind of just think maybe of artwork. But it was people, Russians from there, understand the message that was being sent. Putin was saying to the oligarchs, things have changed. The rules are different now. You need a patron. The icon is a patron saint. You need a patron. You need to look at having a patron for your own best interest that way. So clearly, you have a consolidator of Russia after all those hard, disorganized years with the economy collapsed, people not knowing what they're going. Putin comes up into power. We've had him in our news over the last year and further back. But who is he? Really, what I think we're looking at in the person of Putin, John, is somebody, of course, a survivor, who former KGB, who came out of that background, posted in Dresden in East Germany in the DDR, and deciding what he's going to do. This, you have a history, you have to live with it. Everyone has a background. But to paint him now as a communist just is not accurate whatsoever. Putin came forward. He realizes that Russia has to be protected, steps need to be taken, or you're going to have happen there exactly what was happening in South Africa. They saw this going on. They saw what was happening. The market transition was not some good thing for Russian people, but they were too weak in the 1990s to do anything about it.
So where are they now with the whole globalist agenda?
Where they're at is Putin, and this is on video. You can go on YouTube. It's all there, and it's been there for a long time, for years now, has said in open, I mean, of course, you would need to understand Russian. You can use the subtitling, but has spoken for a long time. Putin has spoken for a long time about the fact that you have a Western elite, again, who I call the upper floor, who have been manipulating and trying to get their hand in Eastern Europe, in Ukraine. This is what you've got going on here. Of course, you know, you've had NATO troops over recent half year posted in the Baltic republics, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, right up against the borders of Russia. Clear provocation, clear jingoism, but yet the mainstream media saying that the Russians are the ones that are bellicose and the aggressors. Well, if you're an honest person looking at both sides, if you have this kind of equipment moved up right against your border, how are you as a person going to feel? It's no different than what you had in the 60s with Russian missiles put in Cuba when John F. Kennedy was president.
Well, worse than that, it would be like the Russian or Chinese armies, complete with some Air Force components and Navy out there on the ocean, running maneuvers right across the Texas border in Mexico. That's what it would be like.
Exactly, like in Mexico. That's a very good example. It's not just cars. Yes.
MCR, I want to ask your opinion of something. Recently in the news, or whatever you might call it, has been some information to the effect that many Muslim refugees, it was specified, not refugees, Muslim refugees, are opting for Mexico rather than the United States. I have a theory that they will be going to the east coast of Mexico, where they will discover their Middle Eastern roots, ROTS. You know, most people don't know that EL, as in El Alamein, that's a prefix. The suffix is EZ, Gomez, Sanchez, Gonzalez, Vasquez, pick one. That's an Arab suffix. And the garbanzo bean, well, those are called chickpeas, but of course it's not, that's English, but that's what they're called in the Middle East. They have seeds that are, you know, in a museum in Mexico that are 7,500 years old. And I guess people think that because they're called garbanzo beans, they must be of Mexican origin, and they're not. And what I'm thinking is, the Islamists are very patient. You wouldn't know it to see some of their behavior, but they waited a long time before they started pulling the ripcords on their chest packs with these and truck attacks, and or rather using trucks to attack. It's not a truck attack. It's a person using a truck to attack. Splitting hairs here, but I think it's necessary because that's how mainstream media portrays it. It was a truck attack. Yeah, the truck was taking Valium and went crazy and attacked some people. No, it was the lunatic Islamist inside the truck that launched the attack. I think they're going to form a huge Muslim cell. I think there's going to be a radical, huge Islamist cell in Mexico, right down there across the Rio Grande, which is shallow enough you won't even get your sneakers completely covered if you walk across it in some places. It's really sort of a more of a trickle than an actual river in places, about like the Jordan is in Israel.
Like the Jordan, you can jump across it exactly. What you've got going on is, now I'm not down there on the Texas border, I'm not in El Paso myself, but what I'll say is this, when we speak about, we hear this language lone wolf in the mainstream media often, and you have to ask yourself the question, are we dealing with lone wolves? If one thinks that, what's the proof of that? We're dealing with a long period of time process. Now, for this to be properly understood, we should have some background this way. And we're really looking back into the past, not just some local last few years kind of events, or even what's been going on in recent years in Europe this way. Europeans get this a little more because they had prior invasions of Europe this way. Now, you'll get arguments brought forward, and it's mentioned, the same old conventional things are brought up, the Crusades and such. Keep in mind, you have something that happened. You had a battle. You had a battle. The first Crusade did not begin until 1095, the first Crusade. You had an advance by Islamic Turkish armies out of the east. There was a battle at a place called Mazenkert in 1071. So you do your math. You know which date is earlier. The Crusades, though I cannot agree with them whatsoever, I don't agree with what happened. You had all kinds of horrible things happen. But we have to keep in mind, being honest historians and examiners of those facts and details, that the First Crusade only happened as a defensive response to the Battle of Mazenkert, which happened a generation earlier. That's not even mentioning what you had prior to that. You had an Islamic army advancing up, which came across North Africa, across the Gibraltar Strait, up into France in the middle of the 700s.
That's it. Well, it was, most of the Crusades were to repel an invasion.
Well, this is it. You're in the middle of the 700s. You have an Arab Islamic army in the middle of France, centuries before the First Crusade even began. I speak about this because we have this constant argument that there are bad feelings because of the Crusade. Well, you have to understand this in context. You had defensive wars, and the advance out of Arabia, out of the Islamic world, into Europe preceded even the First Crusade. This army in the middle of France, you tell yourselves, by yourselves as listeners, was not to deliver flowers. And what we have today in Europe, you have an advance not unsimilar to what happened in the past. Europeans get it, but Europeans have also been softened, so there hasn't been people in a state where they're asking the question that should be asked about what's going on. But these are the same questions that Americans should be asking as to what is going on right now. So what is coming up from Mexico, this buildup this way, is not different than what you have coming up out of North Africa and up out of the Middle East. The two are not, this is not a worlds apart kind of thing.
Not in the least. And, we hear the term Reconquista. Well, according to what I'm reading here, the Reconquista, Spanish for reconquest, describes the period of history of the Iberian Peninsula spanning approximately 780 years between the Islamic conquest of Hispania in 711 and the fall of the last Islamic state in Iberia at Granada to the expanding Christian kingdoms in 1492. The Reconquista was completed just before the European discovery of the Americas, the New World, which ushered in the era of the Spanish colonial empires. So,
apologists for Islam, not just Muslims, not just Muslim scholars, apologists for Islam will oft bring up a beautiful kingdom, caliphate, that existed in Iberia in speaking about Al-Andalus, it's brought up all the time, and you'll have language like when they were in their golden era, the city of London was just mud huts, that kind of a language, kind of to put forward the idea or argument that what we're letting in the doors now is going to recreate that kind of thing. We have to understand something right away, and I hope your listeners will, John, and kind of meet in the middle this way. The medical knowledge, the scientific knowledge that you add in Al-Andalus that is called Islamic is not indigenously Islamic. It was borrowed from Jewish people that had to serve in the courts of different Islamic rulers. It was borrowed from Zoroastrianism in Persia centuries before it was imported westward. That's why Al-Andalus was at a higher place of culture than Europe at that time. We have to give credit where it's due. Now, this presence that you had here at this time was a tempered society. It wasn't a pure Quranic Islam. It was an alloy. It was like an electrium type of thing. It was a mixture this way. And you won't have a repeat this way. I mean, you can see people up at the top of the European Union attempting to build this with the Euro-Mediterranean Union, but we have to keep something in mind. You don't really have golden eras in history past. The golden eras that we think we've had are simply us wanting to remember the good parts of the story.
Sure. It's human nature, isn't it? The
thing human nature.
Earth to overcome. Oh, brother.
God. Now, there is human will. We all agree with it, Enlightenment thinking for something better. But what has happened is the Enlightenment mentality within a lot of Western Europeans with the rationalism and your influence from Descartes and Hume and such, while it has its good parts when we speak about Kepler and all of the scientific advances, yes, I agree, those are the good parts. But the other side of it is it softened Europeans to think that others, people from other places, are the same as us. They think the same, and if they're only given an opportunity, they will just immediately catch up with us. It'll be dialogue. It won't be violence. It won't be an issue of a danger there. And this kind of psychology is what is creating on the street in cities in Western Europe a reality where people are getting attacked and their European governments are ignoring what is going on. It's blocked. I'll give you an example. When I used to live in Germany and I'd go online and, you know, you'd watch some YouTube music video, for example, I could see one video in Germany or France, or I'd be in Czech Republic and I could watch a video, but then I'd go over the border, not even an hour away into Germany, and I couldn't see the same video on YouTube. It would say not available in your country, or it would say something about GEMA copyright laws and what have you. So why am I saying this? You have people in each of these countries, even though we say it's all one European Union, so they must kind of be on the same wavelength, they are not getting the same sets of information, John.
Absolutely.
And even more so, we are not getting what is going on over in Europe, here in North America. Well, we have some, but that's only because of social media tools. It's not because of the mainstream media, your corporate media, letting us in on what's actually happening on the ground. So this reality we have is one where we need to ask, okay, I've heard this, I've heard what is being shared here. If what is going on, we see what's happening, how things are becoming very different in Europe, in the sense of Western Europe, Paris, the whole center of Paris is being changed. You're looking at Berlin, Frankfurt, big changes. Now, I want to say this. I want to say this because I get asked this like you do. MC, do you have an issue with refugees? No. I've worked with refugees for the majority, there is no issue or problem with them. 9/10 of refugees and immigrant groups that I've been exposed to, there is not an issue with them. It is only with a 10th part of those refugees that we are talking about, one half of that 10th part that we have an issue with, where we are dealing with people who, if we leave them alone to themselves, we are going to have more issues on the ground, as we've seen in Sweden, as we've seen in Germany and elsewhere. We're going to have this where we are. It's not to say the majority, there's an issue with. Most people just want to have a good home, food for their family, house, what have you. Most are like that. But it's kind of like police on the street. Police are armed. They don't just have a badge. They're armed because bad people do bad things. Now, you can talk with somebody who's come with an intent of harm, but they're probably not going to have a chit-chat with you. That's why your police that work in your neighborhoods and your city government, your sheriff's office, why they're armed this way. Now, we've known that in the United States. That's not anything new. But even in places like Sweden, not sure if your viewers are familiar with this, but in years past, most Swedish police were not armed. They weren't armed because your average Swedish citizen was so passive in their nature that they didn't need to arm their police to deal with their own people. It's only been in recent years that they've had to issue to their officers pistols or larger, because the violence has escalated to what it is. It's not just in communities like Malmö in the southwest of Sweden. You have flashpoints across the country, but these realities are being suppressed. Same in Germany. What's going on in Germany is, in order to carry out a larger project, we have to let some uncomfortable things happen. You've heard this kind of language. We've got to go through some growing pains. We've got to do these steps, but it's going to be better later. Well, if you're living in some elite compound or nice neighborhood or what have you, that's nice to speak to that. But if you're like most people, most of you listening, and you're living in a regular neighborhood, well, these issues are going to touch into your lives. There's no doubt about it. It's just a matter of time. Europe, Western Europe is your example. The Eastern European governments who have said, no, thank you, Brussels. We don't want any of this. We didn't start these wars. We don't want to import any refugee issue. If people come in and they're from certain places, it may be fine. These Eastern European countries have brought in immigrants from other countries, but they're of a kind of refugee where these people want to be a part of that society. They're not fighting against it from the inside. So we've got to differentiate between these two things. The Eastern European governments are your message that this is not some difference of opinion. You have real issues that you need to think about. This is not just some thing where people have a party on the street and get wild one night like it's some crowd that pours out of a pub. That's not what this is about.
Well, it's about survival of a civilization is what it is. It's about changing survival. Everything. It's about let's just say it like it is. It's about succumbing to the Islamic invasion. It's about subjugation of Western civilization. It's about rape and murder. It's about power and it's about destruction and nothing more.
Now, if this was a matter about immigrants in general, how is often pasted out by your corporate media, immigrants and the conservative side of person doesn't want any immigrants, that's just a flat out lie. You've got people from many backgrounds. It's just when people are coming up, like for example, up here in Canada, you have people coming in from, you name it, Brazil, they're coming from China, people coming from the Philippines, people coming from different African countries, brown, lighter, you name it. Across the spectrum with their phenomes, their looks. but you're not having violence issues with those immigrants. So let's, again, differentiate between the two different things that we're speaking about, so we know that we are, what we need to do is to define our language. We need to know what we're talking about when we're communicating with others and say, this is not an immigrant issue. This is about a portion of people who are not interested in a constitutional society, a republic, where we want to buy into the body politic and be a part of it. We want to come with an allegiance, with a loyalty. Because if immigrants come in and they're all for that and they're good with that, then there's no problem. There's no problem with those people.
No, there isn't. And so, again, we're trying to be Western and we're trying to be accommodating. We're trying to be fair. And, all right, can I use the N-word? We're trying to be nice. The problem is, as I see it, and look, there but for the grace of God goes John Wells, the angry black man or the radicalized Muslim or whatever. But I'm not an angry black man, nor am I a radicalized Muslim. And I say, as a descendant of Western Europeans, that we really can't risk 10% of these immigrants being willing to visit the kind of destruction that was visited upon, let's say, the concert goers this past weekend. We simply can't do this. So, I mean, if Mr. Trump can get his extreme vetting, fine. That's fine. Vet everybody. I mean, we're going through a residency and eventual citizenship deal here in my family.
Something has to be remembered, John, if I could include this for your listeners.
Absolutely.
You have a kind of a picture being painted in your corporate media that your travel ban by President Trump is some outrageous, draconian measure that is being put forward. We have to keep in mind what has gone on in this country, in the United States before. When you had immigrants coming in through Ellis Island, there are some in through Galveston, of course, but primarily Ellis Island, the process that immigrants coming in had to go through were 10 times more than what is being done with Trump's current policies.
Absolutely.
And plans. But it's not, but this is not being told to the American people. Another point on this, you've had the same kind of thing done by every country. Canada had the same thing with their Pier 21 in Halifax, with immigrants coming in this way. Different European countries in the past, before politicians and people began to buy into all of this Skinner behavioralism and their mentalities changed this way and softened down and let's be nice and what have you. And it's like this. It's not about being an unreasonable person. It's like you've got an elite, you have your Hollywood types in their gated communities. And I don't mean to sound cliche, this has been spoken before, but let's look at it. If it's all about to ask questions and to vet being that meaning that one is a mean person, well, leave the gates to your complexes and your mansions open. Leave the deadbolts open on your front doors. Bring in some of these migrants, refugees, whatever synonym you happen to be using. Bring them into your living room. See what it's like. Now, over in Europe, you've had cases where not just a few, many, where people, young women, wouldn't recommend this, have let refugees into their apartments, feeling sorry for them, young man coming in. And of course, I don't need to say to you, you know what happened as a result of that attempt at hospitality.
Yeah,
you have to be.
The women were raped senseless, some of them to death, which has not been reported, and horribly and permanently disfigured during and after the rape.
Yeah, this is not something where you've got people saying, here we go, we've got immigrants and trying to dehumanize and we wouldn't trust them to come into our homes. Look, most people in their own homes would hesitate to even let someone who is homeless off the street, who is American-born, to come in the door of their house. So we're not speaking about some kind of general meanness or antipathy towards anybody of any sort of immigrant background. We're talking about not letting people with malintent into the country wholesale with no program and policy in place to ask questions, just like we had at Ellis Island in the past with European forebears coming in this way. Now, I wanted to add something here, if I might, John, as an addition. There has been this attempt to speak about the Constitution of the United States being some kind of not nice document that was dreamed up, put into place, used to hold down people by white Americans. Now, I think we need to do some historical research there, in all fairness with it. Now, half of the Constitution, its background, its inception, its history is from European origin, primarily coming from your English common law. We're talking about your petition of right, different laws put into place, habeas corpus, so that rulers, barons, dukes, people in power couldn't simply just grab the common person and throw them in jail without a trial. That's why these things were written up. They were not written up by white supremacists. That's a lie. The document was put into place as a check and balance system. I say this as a non-American, but we have to be honest about it. The Constitution was written up as a check and balance system to protect the average person on a bad day. And half of the Constitution's background, by the way, isn't even of a European background with that English common law. It has an Iroquois Confederacy background. And I want to mention this, being a Mohawk, that Indigenous people on this continent here on Great Turtle Island are by and large very good and of hearts that are disposed towards the United States, even, yes, with the rough history, but being fair in these present times of the need and of the strength of the U.S. Constitution, because they know, those who've done their homework, not everyone has, but those who've done their homework, knowing that the U.S. Constitution was drawn out of the material of the Iroquois Confederacy Great Law of Peace. That has to be understood. It's not some kind of white European background thing, hold down other people. It's made for everybody. And Indigenous Americans, Native Americans, First Nations up here in Canada, those who've done their homework and can think beyond the subjective into the wider objective, get that. I get that.
I get it too. You know?
We've got a reality, John, just while you're thinking on your thought, where we have to look at many different movements of parts all at the same time. And obviously one would say, well, of course, MC, that the more we know would probably be a better thing. Unlike, say, 20 years ago, dealing now like we are, all the social media platforms, all the news coming in, it's like what Alvin Toffler spoke about back in the 1970s when he wrote his book, Future Shock. So much, he saw ahead, he saw this. People say, well, you can't know what's coming down the road. Yes, you can. It's like King Solomon said, there's nothing new under the sun. Book of Ecclesiastes, you can get enough pieces together to go, okay, I get it. This is human behavior. This is how kings of the earth behave. This is how most people will do things if you put them into a corner and push them. You have this, so much information coming in, and we recognize, we can be fair about this, all of the info coming in is a lot for people to handle all at one time. I've had friends of mine say, we know you sift all of this info and it's kind of like fun for you, like sports in a way. What do you do with that? Don't you ever get tired with it? Like, are you stepping away from some of it? Yeah, of course. I go and do sports. I like to play volleyball. I like to go swimming. I do stuff to relax myself down. I do some boxing. I do stuff so I can relax my mind away from it, because, yeah, I need to sift stuff out in my mind. that's coming in through your Twitter, your YouTube, all of your stuff. Yeah, it's a lot for me, just like it's a lot for you.
Well, as it says in the Bible, what makes you think you were not born for a time such as this? I'll tell you what, may I just, my Russian's not very good, but can I just say, Gospodin Malodets, you got bolshoi semeniki, pal. You really do, to come on and talk this stuff. And I wish that, I'll tell you what, I want to make, now I'm asking your permission on the program here. I want to make this download available from our membership website. I'm going to give it to the caravanners first, and then I want to offer it as a free download to as many people as would like to have it, because this has been the most comprehensive discussion of what's happened in Russia, Ukraine, Crimea, Western Europe. I mean, this has been a spectacular overview that really only an educator, a teacher with students can do. Otherwise, it's just bits and pieces and fragments and so forth. But I don't mean to gush, but I guess I'm going to a little bit, because this has been a marvelous, most comprehensive analysis of what's happening to us, because people do not understand what's happening to us. But
We've only scratched the surface.
Well, I'll tell you what. Then let's plan to get back together again in the not-too-distant future. I'm talking 30, 45 days. Let everybody have an opportunity to digest what has been done on this episode. And then let's scratch past the surface and dig down into the, as deep as you want to go with it. Because it's now or never. If we don't do something about this now, at least to raise awareness. Now, people are too afraid. Oh, no, I just want to remain in a state of denial here where I'm comfortable. Then that's fine. All you have to do is just click your mouse and you're out. But if you want to know, and that's what we ask, and it's not some chest-beating thing. It's true. Before you join this program, you have to ask yourself a question. Do I really want to know? If you don't, then this program is not for you. If you do, then come on in, because there's some stuff waiting for you. Fantastic. Fantastic program today. Thank you.
We can, John, thank you very much. We can definitely look at what you've said.
All right. And your new book, White Stone, White Stone and a New Name, will be released. Can you give us an idea when that might be coming out?
Hopefully in the near future, looking to release that through Amazon. I'll definitely give you information more on that. You can find out more about that. Can I give an address?
Absolutely.
You can check for release of information concerning my autobiography at RBTMTalk on your Twitter is the way to reach us.
Well, all right. Write it on the wall. We'll be in touch. And thank you again so very much. God bless. And may he bless you and protect you as you reveal the truth, which in this day and age is a very, very volatile commodity.
Much appreciated, John, and to your caravan audience.
Thanks again. Bye-bye for now.
Thanks, John.
Was he something or was he something? I thought that was the most amazing dissertation I've ever heard. I feel like I've just had a 6-hour history course in about, I don't know, 2 hours, 2.5, something. But this is for real. You're armed now. You're armed with the truth. More powerful than a locomotive. We got the internet now, so it's faster than the speed of the bullet. Hopefully it won't come to the bullets. If enough of us become aware, the bullets will not be necessary. But I'm telling you, those who refuse to accept the truth, the ones who refuse to evolve, will now and will always face war. If you have not experienced war, you can trust me on this. You don't want to. Be seeing you.